Chapter 7. The Pit. Billy Doos. We see, and we have said, that Potiphar's wife, in the third year of her passion, the tenth of Joseph's sojourn in the chamberlain's house, began to tender her love to Joseph, and with growing vehemence. At bottom, there is no great difference between the revealing of the second year and the tendering of the third. The one was comprised in the other, and the line between them was fluid. But there was a line, nonetheless, and to pass from attentions and longing looks, even though desire was implicit in them, to actual invitation, cost the woman a self-conquest almost equal to the effort required to conquer her weakness and renounce her desire for her servant. Almost, but probably not quite, since obviously she must have preferred this to the other. She did not do it. Rather than overcome her love, she overcame her pride and her shame. Hard enough, but yet somewhat easier, a little, because she was not alone in this struggle as she would have been in the other. For Dudu, the begetting dwarf, helped her, going to and fro between her and the son of Jacob, playing with great dignity and in his own mind for the first time the role of attached patron, counselor, and messenger, and fanning the flame on both sides with all the strength of his lungs. For Dudu at length understood that there were two fires, not only one, that Joseph's pedagogic plan of salvation, by means of which he need not avoid the mistress, but might stand before her nearly every day, was just an absurd and asinine pretext, since he, consciously or not, already found himself in the state of the god when his wrappings were rent. Dudu understood all this quite as well as did the quaking little mock vizier. For in this sphere, his perceptions were not only equal but superior to those of his small colleague. "Steward," said he at Joseph's end of the route, "you have so far known how to make your fortune. Even envy, of which I am incapable, would concede that. You have trodden down those above you, despite your doubtless respectable but modest origins. You sleep in the private room of trust, and the perquisites in which the Osiris Montcalm once rejoiced, the corn, beer, bread, geese, linen, and leather, you are now the one whom they rejoice. You take them to market, since it is impossible you should consume them. You increase your wealth, and seem to be a made man. But what is made can be unmade, and what is won can run away, as happens often in the world when a man knows not how to hold his good fortune, nor how to secure it by unshakable foundations that it may endure forever, like a temple of the dead. Indeed, it must happen again and again that only some one thing is lacking to crown such a man's fortune and make his unshakable success, and he would need but to put forth his hand to grasp it. But from shyness or obstinacy, slackness or even conceit, the fool refrains, folds his hand in his garment, and wilfully does not put it out to grasp this final success, but neglects it, despises it, and whistles it down the wind. And the consequence? The sad consequence is that all his luck and his gains ebb away. His good fortune is level with the ground, and his place knows him no more, all because of that one refusal. For he lost credit with powers which had thought to accompany his success with their last and highest favor, that it might last forever. But being thus despised and insulted, rage like the sea. Their eyes shoot fire, and their hearts rouse up a sandstorm like the mountains of the east, so that they not only turn their faces away from the man's fortune, but set themselves against it in their wrath, so that they entirely destroy it, which costs them no effort at all. I doubt not that you see my concern as an honest man for your welfare. Indeed, not for yours alone, but also and equally for that of the person to whom my words, I hope unmistakably, refer. Yet they are the same. Her good fortune is yours, and yours hers. This conjunction is long since a happy truth, and it only remains to give it blissful reality. For when I think and ruminate in my soul what voluptuous delight this union must prepare for you, I, the strong man, reel and am giddy. I speak not of fleshly bliss, in the first place out of modesty, and in the second because it goes without saying that it will be very great, considering the silken skin of the person in question, and the wonder of her build. I refer to the delight of the soul, through which the fleshly must be heightened beyond any measure, and will consist in the thought that you, of certainly respectable but yet quite modest origins, and a foreigner, are holding in your arms the loveliest and most noble lady in the two lands, and that you have evoked her profoundest sighs, as it were in token that you, a youth of the desert and of misery, have subdued Egypt, which sighs beneath your weight. And wherewith do you repay this mutual bliss, of which one ever spurs the other up to fresh heights? You pay it not, but are paid for it, paid by the unshatterable perpetuation of your fortune, in that you will have risen to be the true lord and master over this house. For who possesses the mistress, said Dudu, is in truth the master. He raised his stumps of arms as though before Potiphar, and symbolically kissed the ground before Joseph's feet. The latter had listened, though with disgust, to the pander's very common and offensive words, but he had listened, so that the arrogance with which he replied was not wholly becoming. I should, dwarf, be better pleased if you spoke not so much of your own motion, nor developed so many of your marvellous ideas, for they are little to the purpose, but instead would confine yourself to your office as messenger and informer. If you have something to tell me from a higher source, then do so. If not, then begone. I should, answered Dudu, put myself in error to be gone before I discharged my office, for I have something to deliver and hand over. It will perhaps be permitted to the messenger and announcer from so high a source that he somewhat adorns and enlarges upon the message. What is it? Asked Joseph. And the gnome handed something up to him, a note on papyrus, a long, narrow slip, on which Moot, the mistress, had written some words. For at the other end of the route, the mischief-monger had said, Let your loyal servant, my lady, by which I mean myself, speak to your very soul in saying that the pace of time in which things move forward is a vexation to me, for it is sluggish and stagnant, and that pinches my inwards with anger and grief for your sake, for that your beauty might suffer under it. Not that I have seen it suffer. Thanks to the gods, it flourishes in plenteous bloom, and has such abundance that it might lose much and still radiantly excel the common human measure. Thus far, all is well, but your honour suffers, if your beauty does not, and therewith mine too. Under the state of things, and in your relation with the youth who is set over the house, who calls himself Osarsif, but whom I would call Nefer-Nefru, for certainly he is the most beautiful of the beautiful. Does the name please you? I have contrived it for your use, or not actually contrived, rather overheard and picked up to put at your service, for so is he often named in the house, as upon the land and the waterways and in the city. Yes, the women on the housetops choose to call him so, against whose behavior, unfortunately, one could not take any serious measures. But let me go on with my considered words, for it gnaws your devoted servant in his very liver, for the sake of your honor, that you approach so slowly your goal in the matter of this Nefer-Nefru, your known purpose being that you may come upon the sources of his power and bring him to a fall, as he names to you his name. I have indeed contrived and brought about that mistress and man no longer approach each other with scribes and attendants, but converse without restraint or burdensome formality, just four eyes and two mouths, and in some appointed place. That improves the prospect that in some most sweet and secret hour he will at last name you his name, and you will swoon with the bliss of your triumph over him, the wicked one, and all those whom his mouth and eyes have beguiled, for you will seal his mouth in such wise that his beguiling speech will fail him, and his all-enchanting eye grow dim in the bliss of surrender. But the trouble is that the youth defends himself against trying a fall with you, which in my eyes is rank sedition, and a sort of shameless shamefacedness, as Dudu does not hesitate to call it. For what is it? You would assault him and bring him to his fall. You, child of Amun, the flower of the southern house of women. And he, the Shabirite Amu, the foreign slave and son of the depths, he, forsooth, resists. He will not what you will. He hides himself behind accounts and affairs of the household. That is not to be borne. It is rebellion and presumption on the part of the gods of Asia, who owe tribute to Amun, the lord in his chapel. Thus the affront to the house, which earlier consisted in the growth and advancement of this slave, has now become the open insurrection of the gods of Asia, who will not pay their due tribute to Amun, which is the downfall of this youth to your power, who are a child of Amun. To this must it come. I have given timely warning, but neither, great lady, can a just mind quite absolve you, or wash you white of guilt in this abomination that the affair does not go forward, for you do not press it. In maiden delicacy you allow the youth to play his game with Amun, the king of the gods, by feints and shifts putting him off from moon to moon. That is frightful, but it is your maidenliness that is responsible, by lacking in boldness and in ripe experience. You will pardon your true servant his words, for else whence shall you acquire that which you lack? For now it must be that without scruple or ceremony you must summon the slippery one and challenge him to his fall, so that he cannot escape. If your modesty forbids you to achieve this by word of mouth, then there is the written way, and the billet doux, which he must understand when he reads, whether he will or no, for it should run in some such wise as, "Will you overcome me today at a game? Shall we try conclusions alone together?" For so can ripeness and audacity clothe itself in a maidenly garment of speech, yet make itself understood. Let me prepare the writing instruments, and write as I dictate, that I may bring him to it, and make a conclusion of the business to the honor of Amun. Thus Dudu at this end, the sun-potent dwarf, and Aene, dazed and femininely submissive to his authority and knowledge of the field, did write to his direction that which Joseph now read. He could not conceal the redness of autumn that flew to his cheeks, though it angered him so that he ungently drove away the messenger without any ado. Yet despite anxious whisperings from another quarter, bidding him not to obey the artful challenge, he did obey it, playing a game with the mistress in the columned hall beneath the image of Re Horakhte. Once he drove her into the water, and once let her drive him, so that defeat and victory were even, and the result of the meeting was nothing at all, to the great disappointment of Dudu at this new hitch in affairs. So then he took the next and last step, and presently he could say to Joseph out of the corner of his mouth, "I have something to deliver from a certain source." "What is it?" Joseph asked. Then the dwarf handed up to him a narrow slip, of which one may say that it did indeed give a desperate push to the plot, for it contained, quite baldly and unmistakably, the word which I called a word of mistaking, on the ground that it was not the word of a strumpet, but of a woman overwhelmed. True, it was couched in the roundabout way which the written word permits, and in especial the Egyptian, in which it was, of course, set down. The delicate conciseness of the picture-writing, which, with the vowels left to the imagination, with the everywhere interspersed symbols suggesting the category of the consonantally crisply invoked sounds, always has something of the magic rebus, of flowery half-concealment and witty anagram, so that, in fact, it seems made for the confection of billet doux, and the simplest statement receives an elusive and ingenious cast. The decisive part of Mut M. Ennett's communication, what we should call the point of it, consisted of three word symbols, with others equally pretty preceding them, and following them the quickly sketched symbol of a lion-headed couch with a mummy lying on it. The rebus meant lying or sleeping, for the two words are the same in the language of Kempt, and the whole line on the papyrus slip, signed with the symbol of a vulture, said quite plainly and unmistakably, "Come, let us sleep together for an hour." What a document! Precious as gold, highly moving and self-respecting, if also most evil, distressing, and dangerous in its nature. We have here, in its original form, in the original version and the phrasing of the Egyptian language, the words in which the wife of Potiphar, according to tradition, couched her imploring offer to Joseph. For first, in this written form, she addressed it to him, empowered by Dudu, the begetting dwarf, who prompted her out of the corner of his mouth. But if the sight of it moves even us, then how must Joseph have felt when he had deciphered it? Pale and startled, he crumpled the paper in his hand and chased Dudu away with the handle of his fly-brush. But he had now received the message, the sweet suggestion, the longing and promising call of his loving mistress, and if he could not in honor be greatly surprised at it, yet it shook him mightily, and made such havoc in his blood that we might fear for the strength of the seven reasons if we did not, while still involved in the present feast hour of our story, already know how it came out. But Joseph, to whom it happened when it played itself for the first time, actually lived in that hour, was unable to see beyond it, and could by no means be certain of the outcome. It was all in suspense at the point whither we are arrived, and at the moment when it was actually decided, it was to be touch and go whether the seven reasons would hold or would be dissipated into air and Joseph yield to sin. It might just as well have gone wrong as to have gone, as it did, right by the thickness of a hair. Certainly Joseph knew himself resolved not to commit the great error, not to wreck his good faith with God, but the wise little dwarf had been right when he had seen in Joseph's pleasure in his freedom of choice between good and evil something very like pleasure in evil itself, not only in the freedom to choose it. Certainly an unconfessed inclination to evil, interpreted only as a pleasure in the glorious freedom of choice, includes the other inclination, namely, to pull the wool over one's own eyes and cloud one's understanding to the point of seeing the good in it. God had such wonderful intentions with regard to Joseph. Did he really mean to grudge him the proud and honeyed satisfaction which offered itself, which perhaps he himself was offering? Might not this satisfaction be the destined means of the elevation in the hope of which the snatched-away one lived, and which had so far prospered in the house, that now the mistress had cast her eyes upon him to covet him, naming to him her sweet name, longing to name the name of all Egypt, and thereby to make him, so to speak, the lord of all the world? What youth, to whom the beloved yields herself, would not liken this to his elevation to the lordship of the world? And was it not just this, to make him lord of the world, that God designed for Joseph?